discussion of tentative waste discharge requirements for agricultural treatment units, Pacific Gas and Electric Company, Sinkley Compressor Station, San Bernardino County. And before we start, so I can get a scheduling sense, there's a presentation, and could I get a sense of how long that might be?
About 15 minutes.
So what I think I'd like to do is take the presentation, and then we'll take a break, and we'll come back for comments from members of the public, people in the audience. Again, I would ask you, please get your comment card in so that we can get all the public comment before we turn to discussion at the board level. So with that, can we proceed then with item number 3?
We need to bring two our advisor, technical advisors up here first. Doug and Judy, they'll be up here.
Thank you. I think they know that because they're walking up. So it would appear that they're aware of that.
You might want to explain.
So you will notice that we've been joined by two of our staff members who are advisors to the board on this topic, so they've come up here so that they can provide us with that advice as we need it.
Good evening, Chairman and members of the board. Again, I am Ann Holden, geologist in the Water Board South Lake Tahoe office. I'm going to discuss item 3, which is a workshop on tentative waste discharge requirements for agricultural treatment units to remediate chromium and groundwater in the Hinkley Valley. So the chronology of this item is back in July of 2013 here in Barstow, the Water Board certified the Environmental Impact Report, or EIR, for comprehensive cleanup of chromium and groundwater. This set the stage for staff to begin developing new permits to allow PG&E to expand the remediation activities. Throughout August and September of 2013, staff came here to Hinkley and met with members of the community, including the Community Advisory Committee, to discuss some different options for structuring agricultural treatment unit permitting. We also came here in October of 2013 to Barstow and held a workshop where we went over some of the options that we developed for developing a permit for agricultural treatment. So then we went back to our desks and wrote these tentative WDRs, which were released on December 13th for a 30-day public review and comment period. So these waste discharge requirements authorize 500 total acres of agricultural treatment units. This reflects option 2 from our October 2013 discussion, which was the limited approach that we discussed. It includes 236 acres of existing agricultural treatment units that are on the landscape now. Those are shown in the black circle. And it also authorizes up to 155 additional acres that are proposed by PG&E for 2014. And that leaves roughly 100 additional acres for adaptive management to be put onto the landscape in the future. And these WDRs also incorporate the entire EIR project area, which is shown on a map in Attachment A of the WDRs. So agricultural treatment units could be constructed anywhere in that EIR project area under these WDRs. So some of the key items, there's quite a bit of monitoring required. A lot of the new monitoring that is in these WDRs is the EIR-specified monitoring, and we've talked a lot about this in previous presentations. There's extensive monitoring of domestic wells for both water quality and water quantity. Pre-remedial monitoring is required, as well as operational monitoring, and then specific investigations for TDS, nitrate, and uranium. There is also monitoring required of the irrigation water that is applied to the fields. And then the agricultural field soil plant tissue monitoring is required, and then, of course, groundwater monitoring around the agricultural fields is included in these WDRs. So two things that I want to talk about specifically that these WDRs authorize have to do with total dissolved solids exceedances and chromium plume bulging, and I'm going to cover those in the next couple of slides. So this is a figure from the EIR, and this shows the project area, and it shows TDS concentrations as of the fourth quarter 2012. And we looked at this data when we were developing some TDS limits in these WDRs. And we looked at it by operable unit, which are described. So in OU1, which is where most of the new agricultural treatment units are proposed for 2014, and the PG&E compressor station is here. So in OU1, the TDS concentrations are generally less than 1,500 milligrams per liter. And for context, I've listed the secondary TDS maximum contaminant levels here. They range from 500 to 1,500 milligrams per liter. So in OU1, they're generally below the highest TDS limit. And then when you get to OU2, you can see that the dots are quite a bit different color. There's a lot of orange and yellow dots there. Those limits, those dots represent TDS concentrations that all exceed that $1,500 milligram per liter upper limit. And this is where most of the existing agricultural treatment units are located. It's also where there's been a lot of active and historic dairy operations that have contributed to those TDS concentrations. So in OU2, the water quality for TDS is not so good. And then we looked at OU3, which is just sort of the outlying areas outside the plume core. And in general, the water quality there for TDS is below 500 milligrams per liter. So it's pretty good. So we took this into consideration when we proposed in these WDRs to allow up to a 20% trigger increase in TDS in OU1 and OU3. And if we see that 20% increase in those areas, this will require PG&E to submit an action plan to reduce TDS concentrations to the extent feasible in those areas. And in OU2, where TDS already greatly exceeds the MCLs, the WDRs acknowledge this and acknowledge that further agricultural treatment in that area could degrade water quality more. This is also acknowledged in the EIR as a potentially significant and unavoidable impact. And there is an EIR mitigation measure 4, which requires PG&E to restore TDS to pre-project levels following the chromium remediation. And so the requirements of EIR mitigation measure 4, again, for any remedial byproduct that's left in the aquifer following chromium remediation, PG&E would need to restore those conditions to pre-project conditions, which they'll be required to establish before moving forward with more agricultural treatment. And some of the possible cleanup methods for agricultural byproducts, such as TDS and nitrate, could involve direct treatment of the water using above-ground treatment, technologies such as reverse osmosis or ion exchange, or a basin-wide approach, which would involve fallowing existing non-remedial fields or changing farming practices at non-remedial fields, such as helping local farmers install drag drip irrigation or improve their manure management practices. And then this would allow there may still be localized TDS increases below PG&E's fields, but on a basin-wide scale, there would be a net reduction of TDS due to those sort of management practices. And the Water Board has to evaluate any benefits of this and approve any proposed basin-wide approach. The next topic I want to talk about is chromium plume bulging. Agricultural treatment can cause temporary lateral movement of the chromium plume, and we call this chromium plume bulging. This was an impact that was discussed in the EIR. And so here's the edge of the plume here. And you can see that there are some agricultural treatment units proposed here that are right on the edge. So currently, we have a cleanup and abatement order that allowed PG&E to bulge the plume for 1,000 feet in a limited area shown in the crosshatch here. And this was done in 2009 to allow PG&E to do additional injections at the in-situ remediation zone area. So the tentative WDRs state that there could be, they could authorize up to 3,000 feet of bulging from the eastern boundary of OU1, and that's shown here. That 3,000 foot area would be this area here. Once the tentative WDRs went out the door, realized that what we intended to allow was not 3,000 feet from the eastern boundary of OU1, but just up to the eastern boundary of OU1. And so that area would be from the edge of the plumes just up to this boundary and not including this. So that was an error, and the proposed WDRs will reflect the intended language or other direction if we're to get that. And I do want to note that in order to allow any additional plume bulging in these WDRs, we'll need to amend that 2008 CAO to allow that. So the comments on the tentative WDRs are due this coming Monday, which is January 13th. There are many ways to get comments to me. They're listed here on this slide, and I've also brought comment forms here tonight with all of the contact information on there. And Gita Kapai can hand those out if anyone's interested to provide comments. Please get a form, and please turn that in one way or another by January 13th. And the next steps are, following the close of the comment period, we will respond in writing to all comments received. We'll then revise the WDRs as appropriate, and then the target date to circulate the proposed WDRs is February 10th. And then for the March board meeting here in Barstow, we would bring you those proposed WDRs for your consideration. That's all I have.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is just take a 10-minute break at this point so we can stretch.
I just want to remind you, if you do have a comment on the previous presentation, to please make sure you get your cards in before the board members have their opportunity to comment. I have one card for this item, and that's Kevin Sullivan, PG&E.
I'm Kevin Sullivan, project manager of PG&E. The time that we use for our update this month, I put together a few slides to maybe elaborate and expand on one aspect of these permits that and there'll be handouts of these slides coming here in a second. And that was the aspect that Ann Holden mentioned about allowing TDS increases in certain areas. I know that may sound like a controversial or why is that necessary? And I put together three or four slides to explain some of the ideas that we're thinking about and that I'd like to just acquaint you with, because as sort of a preview of proposals you may see from us in the future. The important thing for me to emphasize is that these are concept ideas right now. We're looking at trying to come up with innovative ways to, you know, both remediate the plume and manage groundwater quality in the area. So I just wanted to kind of give you a sense of what you might be looking at from us if these permits were adopted. And so the The first slide is a detail very similar to one that Ann Holden showed you. At this stage, these are the what I'll call the near-term units, agricultural units, that we're planning should the permit be adopted in, you know, something like the form it's in now, that we would file a notice of intent for, within a month or 6 weeks of the permit being adopted. So as our understanding is, if the permit was, you know, adopted at the March meeting, we would then be filing sometime during, you know, ideally during April, the specific details of these ag units that we're proposing. And important things to note, these additional ag units are all over the current plume. One of the main things that we're wanting to accomplish with this is to minimize or hopefully eliminate entirely that bulging that folks were talked about, that by pumping these in the center of the plume, it right near the compressor station, this will act as an inward force to kind of pull the high concentration stuff together, keep it from spreading anymore. So we think there's a big benefit to that. We also think that this will move a lot more mass of chromium, and in the long term, that's really what we're after, trying to get the mass of chromium out of the ground. One important item to note is that the landscape in the center of this plume is going to look very different within the next 18 months due to Highway 58 being realigned. We've been working very closely with both board staff and with Caltrans to make sure that the new routing, A, doesn't impact any of the current remedial facilities. I think Caltrans managed to sort of thread the needle. We're only going to need to relocate about 3 or 4 monitoring wells out of about 1,000 out there. So that was a very good job. But it also required us to sort of update our initial design that we prepared in 2010 during the feasibility study, because there'll be a highway running through where some of the places we thought would be farming. So these are the concept level. We've shared these with the community. We've talked about these with the board. We're sort of all moving towards this. We're doing detailed engineering right now under the assumption that this permit will be adopted, and we'll have that package together for, you know, submittal in April. Importantly, all of this takes place in OU1 and OU2. And as we talk about potential impacts in OU1 and OU2, I think it's important to understand the philosophy that I think is embodied in the EIR and in this permit. And that is, you know, number one, there's a very, very small number of residents still in OU1 and OU2. Okay, so this is area that, not entirely, but is largely free of domestic wells. So that's, you know, that's important. And for the domestic wells that are remaining, there's going to be a very robust monitoring program. And if any of these byproducts were to impact those wells, we'd have to make it right. Okay, so we really worked hard to make sure that any short-term impacts to users were addressed and would be both anticipated, so that, you know, ideally we catch it before it's there, or if they were affected, that they would be provided with alternate water. So that is a key part of the units that we're proposing now, and that, given the inward gradients that would be required by these units, our goal is so that any of these byproducts would just stay within this area of the plume, essentially within the current footprint of the chromium plume. So no one would be currently, you know, impacted by them. So in terms of that sort of addresses near-term impacts. There's a larger sort of policy question, though, about, well, should you be impacting the waters of the state at all, right? And that's where we take a step back to the basin level, and a program that we're trying to put together that the EIR allows for is what we call this farm swap proposal. And the idea here, we've now zoomed out a little bit. Here's OU1 and OU2. And within the Hinckley Basin, there's a large amount of farming operations that currently generate, you know, TDS. Many of these facilities also have nitrate issues. So there's a significant, you know, water quality impact that's already going on due to existing, you know, farming in the area. And what we're hopefully going to be able to come to you with a proposal is the idea of idling some of those fields and essentially talking to those farmers and saying, take your farming, use our water that we need to move for remediation and farm over our plume, so that the net TDS impact to the basin as a whole would be zero, because we take some out and we put some in. And as I'll show you in some coming slides, we think that by targeting that farmer's remaining pumping, we can also take a good bite out of some of the nitrate issues over there. So basically, the overall basin approach would be use the water of the lowest quality that you can, make it better while you do it. And so I've made a couple of cartoons to try to explain this, because it gets a little bit hard to follow. So the current conditions, in a very simplified way, think of that map as sort of two areas. On the left, I'm showing a cartoon of the PG&E remediation area, OU1 and OU2. You see a chrome plume, conceptually shown there. Over on the right, you have that farming area, that existing farming area that's already been farmed. And what you'll see is that, typically a farmer puts in a well, he screens it through all the different aquifers, because he's just trying to get water. Right? He doesn't care whether it comes from the shallow aquifer or the deep aquifer. And in the shallow aquifer, what we often find is that's where the nitrate problems are from dairying operation, historical animal husbandry, and the like. So that's a kind of a current concept picture. You can also see the various layers that we talk about. All of what we're talking about is in what is called the upper aquifer in Hinckley. The lower, deeper aquifer is largely unimpacted. Now, once we start remediation, what you see here is we've taken the big green farming area, and we've taken a large amount of that acreage out and moved it over to the PG&E remediation acreage. That farming is supported by water that we're extracting to treat the chromium plume. So the net amount of farming doesn't really change, but it moves over. And we are going to work with the farmers to rebuild their wells so that they're not extracting water from the good, deep, clean water, but they're only focusing on removing water that's impacted with nitrates, which is perfectly good for farming. So what you end up with here is the same amount of water coming out of the aquifer, but you're now targeting just the farmer's nitrate issues, just our chrome issues, but you're still keeping the business going. You're still keeping the farming going. You're still keeping the benefits going to the community of having active farms. That would be the conceptualized situation that we'd run for the lifetime of the remediation. That might be 20, 30, 40 years. I mean, this is a long-term, arrangement that we'd be trying to enter into with the local farmers. Now, the question becomes then, what about the TDS that our farming would generate? And now this is a place that, as I said before, this kind of gets to that intersection of engineering and policy, okay? When you try to predict exactly how much TDS a given farming operation will make, you find that's a very challenging model to do. It depends on rainfall, it depends on what crop you're growing, it depends on how much you're irrigating, it depends on your soil infiltration. You can model it, but there's a lot of, I'll tell you from trying to do this, there's a lot of uncertainty in the models. And what I think we're still reviewing the permit, but I think right now some of the language in the permit looks pretty good in that if we cross one of those triggers, we're looking for the ability to create an action plan that would give us the time to address those TDS impacts. And by setting it up in that way, asking for an action plan, we can push this concept hard. We can farm in the smallest area. We can keep any potential TDS impact in a small footprint in OU1, in OU2, where there are no domestic resources. And then as we get a better grip over the coming decades as to the extent of it, we'll be able to develop better long-term intelligent management plans, for that. If it even happens. Okay, there's no guarantee that it will happen or won't happen. But this idea of kind of adaptive management going forward, we think will allow us to come up with these kind of proposals that we'd like to go back to you. So I wanted to I don't want to take much more of your time, but I wanted to just sort of outline that concept of what we're thinking about. There's still a lot of details to be worked out, but when you're reading these permits and these materials, when you see about allowing temporary localized impacts in of TDS in OU1 and OU2. That's what we're talking about, and that's the greater good that we'd like to be able to try to accomplish. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. The card that I have next on the item of the WDRs, item number 3, is from Billy Hernandez.
I just wanted to clarify. I've already been bought out. You had that doubt. I it took me a long time to get in the program, but I finally got bought out after BG&E put those monitoring wells on my property. The thing that I was getting to is that even though all the people around me had been bought out, I couldn't qualify for a long time, and it was just because my well was so deep. One of the wells in that area has fresh water, it has new water, and it has tritium in it. And if it has that, it has the possibility of where did that come from and where did that chrome come from. And like I said, the things that I've heard in the past are that the natural chrome levels are only from 1.2 to 3.1 in that area. And we've had 7.1 it started in 2004, and it just kept rising, and it got to 7.1. Mine started at 0 and got to 4.1 in a matter of 3 years. So, you know, I've been trying to connect the dots so people that were out of the program, because you, like the shop stops were 300 feet. If they would have connected the dots, they would have been included in these programs. And that's what I was trying to emphasize. You know, if they would connect the dots correctly, PG&E over 30 years has had bought other farms, and then every time they buy a piece of property, a lot of times they dismantle that well. So there's not enough monitoring wells like between our section and the direct plume. I think those spots should be filled in, like the one to the east. It's 2,700 feet away instead of 2,600. If it was 2,600 feet, it would be included, that line would be drawn. And that's what I was trying to get to. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's the last card for this item, so I'll turn it over to the board.
Thank you. It's my understanding that there are questions from the advisory team staff members, so perhaps we could turn to those and then take questions and then comments from the board.
This question's for Ann Holden. Ann, could you get your presentation up on in the one aerial slide showing the bulge?
Yeah.
That 3,000. Okay.
Let's not go there.
Okay.
One more.
I think there's, well, it's that one, and then the other one showing you, or the one that you showed where it was, that one. Okay. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate for the board what is meant by the bulge and why or what reasons you use to determine the bulge limit, which you pointed out with the red line, mm-hmm. and what is sort of the expected duration of this bulge? Is it permanent, temporary? Just add some more info on that.
Okay, sure. So what I mean by plume bulging is either typically it occurs from the direct injections from the in-situ remediation, and it's a lateral movement of the chromium plume line due to additional water being added into the aquifer in a specific area. So it's definitely something that would happen much more prevalently with direct injection. With the agricultural treatment units, as we've talked about before, there's a lot of the water that does get lost to evapotranspiration. So the notion of the irrigation water percolating down to the groundwater table and then kind of causing a mound that would cause the groundwater to move is a little less likely to happen due to agricultural treatment. So the bulge that was allowed in the 2008 amended CAO was to accommodate in-situ remediation. But it could happen, and the reason that we are even talking about it is because during the EIR analysis, we really did try to be very comprehensive in thinking about what impacts could occur as a result of any remediation that might happen. And so plume bulging, even due to agricultural treatment, was something that we disclosed. So so that's what plume bulging is, and that's why we're considering it as something that could happen, even though acknowledging, and I think as Mr. Sullivan said, they expect, due to the groundwater extraction that they'll be conducting for the agricultural treatment, that they'll actually have gradients coming into the extraction wells, and that'll counteract any forces that would push things outward. But out of an abundance of caution, we have acknowledged that this could happen. So the 1,000-foot proposal here, so we'll pretend like this does not exist since that was an error. This is based on the existing plume bulge plus about another 1,000 feet. And the reason that we drew that up to the boundary of OU1 is because we feel like if that did happen, the groundwater gradient would move this way, and extraction wells over here would be able to capture that plume bulge. If we were to allow it all the way out here, there aren't extraction wells out here, and it may not be captured in the downgradient direction. So that's the basis for the limit only up to the OU1 boundary. Is there another?
And then what is the expected time frame or the duration of this bulge? How long would it last?
I don't have a good answer for that. I do know that PG&E in 2009 was authorized to bulge the plume in that area that we showed previously, and that bulging has occurred and is ongoing today.
Last follow-up question on this. Mm-hmm. So could you elaborate just a little bit more on the safeguards that would be in place to ensure that this bulge won't bulge anymore, or expand. Thank you.
Some of the safeguards, just as far as domestic wells, of course, would be that any domestic wells that were impacted by the plume bulge would be required to have replacement water. And then we would keep a sharp eye on the area because we have extensive groundwater monitoring required in the permit. So if we started to see indications that the plume bulge was moving out of the approved of area, then we would require PG&E to adjust their pumping or their agricultural treatment units so that we would see concentrations not moving in the direction that that is outside the allowable limits of the permit.
And I have a few questions, two questions actually as well. One regarding uranium and one regarding drawdown.
Okay.
So regarding uranium, I know we have a regime and proposed WDRs for monitoring for that. And we're looking for buildup in soils. If we find that we have a buildup in soils, what does the WDR, the proposed one, do? How do we manage that if we find a problem?
Good question. Right now, we don't have any follow-up action contained in the WDR. The WDR requires investigation of uranium, and it also requires baseline monitoring of many constituents in the soil, one of which is uranium, and then continued monitoring during the operations. And so if we were to see increasing trends, and we would have to evaluate that against perhaps background or trend analysis. And if it was approaching levels of concern, we would possibly need to require PG&E to stop irrigating in areas of high uranium and cease using those fields if it were to approach areas of concern, levels of concern at a specific field.
Okay, so the proposed WDR gives us the authority to make those adjustments, correct?
It's not explicitly written in the proposed WDR that there's no follow-up action explained in the WDRs. There's the monitoring. So,
This is Lori Kemper again for the record. Just to add to this question, Taddy, you're asking is similar to Doug's question about, you know, how long or, you know, what's going to happen if, and it's good to remember that, you know, this permit is giving authorization for, you know, these activities. But as you know, in the Water Code, the ability to discharge is a privilege, not a right. This doesn't give them some right that stays in place forever. You can revoke the permit at any time, and you can use your other tools to take enforcement actions or direct cleanup. And I think that I wanted to make that point following up on Doug's question about the length of time for the bulge and even the size or, you know, magnitude of it. That's something that, as we get more information as we're moving forward, that could be an additional requirement that's either put in, say, revised waste discharge requirements, or it could be explicit in a cleanup and abatement order, so that as we are moving forward to have a new cleanup and abatement order where we're establishing performance standards, you know, we could say that, acknowledge that, yes, the permit exists and it's authorizing this, however, you know, in 10 years, that we're going to change that number, or you know, there's requirements for you to bring that back in. And as Kevin said, you know, he's hoping for this inward gradient anyway and a shrinking of the plume. And so as time moves on, the board can make different decisions about that or set specific requirements in place. So with uranium, we don't have, that's just one of those areas where we don't have a lot of baseline information. So the permit requires these investigations and the monitoring. And as we get that information, if it's indicating that we need to make a different, you know, change course, then we can revise the requirements and put other kinds of limits in place. So
I would just also add, Patty, from the mitigation monitoring, the mitigation number 4, which is on page 3-98. One of the things that the EIR required, and that's in this WDR, is there's going to be a lot of pre-project monitoring to understand what base levels are. And one of the, you know, understanding that there could be, not just here, but in the IRZs and others, some sort of increases in other constituents, we have a mitigation requirement that you have, PG&E is responsible for bringing everything back down to baseline levels once the chromium remediation is done. And so that's one of the things, you know, that's in this WDR, and that would be a follow-up. If we saw levels changing in uranium, this mitigation requirement would require PG&E to bring those levels back down.
Thank you. I have one more smaller question, and that is the question of drawdown, which has been issued, the discussion and concern. And could you help those of us here on the board understand a little bit better how drawdown is addressed as part of this permit, and also if there was identification of particular areas that were more vulnerable than others to draw down?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So drawdown is addressed in this permit. There's a whole section in the permit that contains the significance criteria for significant impacts in the EIR, and we've talked about those a lot. They were groundwater drawdown, water quality impacts due to chromium or TVS, and so if you look on page 3-31 of your agenda item, there's a whole section called Conditions Triggering Environmental Impact Report Mitigation Measures. And they basically say all of the things that the EIR required as far as if you see this in a well, that means that PG&E needs to provide replacement water to that well, either water quality impacts or water quantity impacts. So for the groundwater drawdown, we used a significance criteria of 25%, a loss of 25% of a wetted screen depth of someone's domestic well would be a significant impact, and PG&E would be required to provide them replacement water supplies. So that's in the permit, and that, of course, they'll have to do the pre-remedial monitoring to figure out what people's wetted screen depths are, what their water levels are now, and then if continue to monitor for a year and then continue monitoring, you know, do all the pre-remedial baseline monitoring for a year and then do operational monitoring throughout the life of the project. So that's in the permit. They're required to do that. And there are areas, when we first brought this concept of agricultural treatment unit WDRs to the community back last summer, groundwater drawdown was definitely a concern. So some of the questions that the Community Advisory Committee asked were, hey, if you put these on the landscape, what will the drawdown look like? And so PG&E went back to their groundwater models and developed some maps showing areas of concern that could happen, and I think the time step they used was 5 years, of where groundwater drawdown was most likely to occur due to the agricultural treatment units. And I think the biggest level of drawdown kind of surrounding in this area would be about 10 feet. And then there was a really small area around the pumping center here that had up to 30 feet of drawdown, but it was, I mean, literally right near just one of the agricultural fields where there's no wells, so it wouldn't affect anybody's well. So we won't know if 10 feet is significant to anybody until we get out there and measure their wells and see what their wetted screen depth is and would that result in a loss of 25% of their wetted screen depth or not.
Thank you, Anne. That was very helpful.
Turning then to questions from the board, starting to my left, Mr. Sandell.
This was a lot of really quite complicated work, it seems to me. The ICF work seemed to be particularly well written and clear at the same time, you know, just with great and with great depth. I assume it had a lot of oversight from us.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really a good job, but it must have taken them a while to produce it. Yeah, no.
Yes.
Yeah. So thanks. It looks great.
Mr. Dias.
No comments or questions.
Dr. Horn.
I have no questions. Are we going to have comments later?
Yes, ma'am. Ms. Cox.
I do have a couple of questions here. Anne, on your slide where it's talking about tentative WDR key items with the showing the field. Slide 3.
Yes.
Okay, the 500 total acres that are authorized here, how many acre feet of water will they be using here? And has there been a discussion about the application at agronomic rates?
Currently, we don't have a specific proposal for PG&E such that we know the amount of acre feet that they will be using. Two things that address that in the EIR and in the permit as well, they must demonstrate that they have enough free production allowance from the Mojave Water Agency to implement any proposal that they bring to us. And so that is contained in there. And then what was your next question, your other question?
Well, the agronomic
yes.
application.
Right. Yes, the WDRs require that water is applied to the field at an agronomic rate, which is, you know, the rate of water that's required, water and nutrients required for plant growth, but minimizes the amount of water percolating to the water table. So they have to demonstrate that they're applying water at an agronomic rate in a yearly report, demonstrating good distribution efficiency, consideration of evapotranspiration, irrigation schedules, seasonal watering, and then one BMP that they're already using that really goes a long way toward achieving that agronomic rate is that drag drip irrigation system that they already use. So these WDRs require them to continue, any new field has to use drag drip as well.
Okay, so if they're applying the water at an agronomically acceptable rate, then wouldn't the bulging, plume bulge, or be minimized or somewhat mitigated by that restriction?
Yes.
On not overwatering?
Yes.
And on the change to 3,000 or from 3,000 feet to the boundary on slide 9, has there been general support for correcting that?
Yes. Right. There has been support from my office from correcting that. I think this is the first time PG&E's heard about it, so I would imagine we may have some comments. My coworker was very supportive of correcting that.
Kimberly, I just wanted to add that you're right that the ag treatment units themselves should not cause bulge, and I think that what Anna tried to describe earlier about flexibility is recognizing that not only is there ag treatment going on in that area, but there's the IRZs, the injection, and in addition to both those operations, we want PG&E to have the ability to bring water from the north south, meaning that they could be pumping and extracting water closer to Santa Fe Avenue and bringing it south, and just that hydrology, those hydraulic changes could could cause that movement, just because they're trying to maintain compliance with our current cleanup order that doesn't allow further migration to the north, and so there may be a need to pump a lot more water from the north and bring it south. So keep that in mind, even though, again, at agronomic rates, that might not cause it. And then the last thing is Mother Nature herself. If it pours down rain, as you know it does, in the desert, there are those kinds of things that PG&E can't control that could also cause a bulge because of a huge inundation of water. And that's something that we're just trying to create that a little bit of an allowance for those kinds of factors.
Thank you.
Mr. Jardine?
No questions.
Starting then with comments, Mr. Jardine.
I'm truly impressed with the work that went into this. And, looking at the commitment to the obligation to go back to baseline levels and your comments regarding the plume or the, I'm sorry, the expansion potentially of plume bulge. I'm in support.
Comments, Ms. Cox?
On the EIR mitigation measures that you talked about on slide 7, I think taking the basin-wide approach is a tremendous idea, and I think it's a template that can be applied in other areas, other projects as well. So I'm just really supportive of that approach. Thank you.
Comments, Dr. Horn?
This is, I think, worth going forward on. I would like to see some language in the WDRs about what happens in the case of the bulge exceeding the line and the uranium exceeding, I mean, I don't know what it is. I mean, you know, not to limit or complicate the future cleanup and abatement order, but just some indication of what those limits might be.
Mr. Diaz?
Yes, thank you. I agree with Ms. Cox. I like the basin-wide approach, especially if it can be designed in a way that results in no net water consumption for the basin. Thank you.
Mr. Sandell?
All good comments, and I think I agree with all of them. And I'll just reiterate my former supporting statement. Yes, thank you.
I also agree with the comments, and particularly hope that, along with Dr. Horn, that some of the matters that were raised by the questions tonight can be dealt with when we see the final document. This is a very impressive piece of work, and thank you very much.
Mind, Chairman, I wouldn't mind asking Amy to elaborate.
Dr. Horn,
sorry. I wrote that down. In terms of you wanting limitation, I mean, I just want to be clear, because I heard you say the word limitation. I also heard you say the word action. And so do you want the WDRs to better explain the limitations, the thresholds, you know, better explain that, hey, this is the line and this is what we mean by the line, and if you cross it, you're in violation? That's one question. Second question is, do you want the WDRs to say, if you cross that line, here's what you'll do about it? You know, we're going to require you to give us an action plan, or we're going to require you to stop pumping, or, you know, I'm just wanting to get clear on what you want to see in this permit, as opposed to, say, a follow-up order or action or revision. So,
I don't want the WDR to be open-ended when it comes to these matters. There should be some indication that there are consequences if the policies set about the bulge and uranium are not adhered to. I'm trying not to box you in, because I don't want it to box in what happens in the CAO.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Anne's nodding her head, so she gets it.
Well, I guess all our permits say if you don't comply, we'll take appropriate action. We have an enforcement authority, and basically if you don't, that's why we have pages and pages of requirements. They are requirements, they are thresholds, they are limits, and if you cross them, then we react, and we have a whole toolbox to react. So I'm just trying to figure out if there's something different than kind of just a standard catch-all, I don't know what to give her for direction on how we would fix what's in the permit today related to these topics. So that I'm just, I think we're going to just do what we normally do, but I just want to make sure there's not something else you're thinking about. And if you can tell us later if you want.
Dr. Horn, may I clarify?
Certainly.
Or try to clarify. This is Richard Booth on the advisory team. Question for and perhaps, or perhaps PG&E. As Kevin Sullivan mentioned, TDS, difficult to model, difficult to predict, it's complicated. But following the groundwater levels of anticipating a bulge and possibly even anticipating drawdown in a domestic well can be better predicted, I believe. I guess I'm asking for confirmation for that, so that perhaps it would be easier to have a trigger, an observation, to anticipate a bulge or excessive drawdown before such a trigger could happen, or this could be written in, perhaps. A question for Anne. Yeah. I mean, is this a reasonable thing to expect?
I would agree for a drawdown for sure, and I don't think that's a problem, because we have pretty specific follow-up actions if we see drawdown, if this, then that. I think Dr. Horn is saying she would like to see something similar for uranium and for chromium plume bulge, if this, then that. And so I think we can come up with some ideas for that. The uranium in soil, we'll have to do some investigation about what kind of trigger limits are out there as far as preliminary remediation goals or other EPA standards, and then try to just maybe frame some follow-up actions that we can put in the permit.
Ms. Holden, you seem, going back to when we were, this question came up originally, you seemed to indicate, you suggested to me that there would be more, it would be possible to write something more along the lines of this, if this, then that in this WDR, and that's all I'm asking for.
I will do my best.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda is